The following is an interview with Laverne Corbett by Mary Hyde by the Kentucky Oral History Commission. We're studying prohibition in Nelson County, its causes and effects. The interview was conducted in Bardstown, Nelson County, Kentucky at 105 Eastview on May the 29th, 1989. Laverne, I understand that some of your ancestors were distillers. Could you tell us a little bit about them and fill us in on your own background? Can you go ahead, Laverne?
Well, I'll try to give you the best I can. I'm sure it won't be as good as the rest of your tapes. I was born in Jefferson County in 1921. My parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents were all born in, on both sides, were born in Nelson County. In fact, my ancestors came to Nelson County in 1780. And they have been connected with the alcoholic beverage from the beginning, before Kentucky was a state. I moved back to Nelson County shortly after I was born. I moved back here shortly after. To bring you up on some of the ancestors, one of the earliest that arrived in Kentucky. There are records showing that they arrived here March the 20th, 1780, before Kentucky was a state, as I mentioned. Old Conrad Kurtz had a cabin in the woods, and later when lots were marked off for people, had to build a one-room log cabin, I think it was 1818 by size, to hold a lot. Well, he decided to build two 1818 foot cabins on the line side by side, one cabin on one lot and one on the other. After old Conrad died, the builder, his son, my great-great-great-grandfather, Jacob Kurtz, inherited the double cabin. It was on lots 94 and 95, I think. There was a lawsuit which lasted for years, but in the end, Jacob did win and received the double cabin. The jury ruled that old Conrad's intention was to acquire two lots by the double cabin. Mm-hmm. Old Conrad came here from York, Pennsylvania. He had three sons and one daughter. His first son, Martin Kurtz, died in 1795. His will is here in Nelson County. From the looks of things, they were in the whiskey business from the start, as his possessions are listed as three stills. The newest one is on the plantation where his wife, Ann Kurtz, was living. I guess the other two boys got the other two stills because they are listed as owners of stills in their will. So to go back to Martin Kurtz, Martin Kurtz, yes. He had two of his daughters that married into the Samuels family, which were owners of distilleries all along. They owned the T.W. Samuel Distillery, and some of the Samuel family still have Maker's Mark Distillery. Those were the Samuels of the Martin Kurtz's two descendants from Martin Kurtz's two daughters. Turned off a minute. So this ties in that they were connected with the whiskey business before, since since they left Germany, even before they went to Pennsylvania and then on into Nelson County. My grandfather was a distiller at the Murphy Barber for years, John Wesley Kurtz. The 1896 record that Historical Society had reprinted, telling about most of the things in Nelson County, has a write-up about him. He was born in 1850 and died in 1940. My father spent a lot of time during Prohibition buying, selling, and etc. with whiskey. My first recollection with it was when I was about 3 years old, maybe three and a half, some revenue agents came to our house, and Mother put us four girls on a couch that sat in front of a closet door, which was concealed by the couch. The agents searched the house and did not find anyone. As one agent left, he took Dad's .38 pistol. My parents called before the agents arrived back at their office, telling about the theft, and the pistol was returned. catch him and fine him for selling whiskey. The fine was in June of 1923. I don't know the story about that. I don't know when they found him or what still he was working at the time. I think they caught him with whiskey. I've heard many stories and seen a lot. He used to deliver whiskey that was drained from barrels at Tom Moore Distillery and take it to Louisville. I do not know who drained the whiskey or who it was sold to. This went on for quite a long time, and probably until the whiskey ran out. The next year, we had moved to Jefferson County, back to Jefferson County, about a mile from where we did live. And the agents returned. They smelt whiskey, and they did not have a search warrant. So they went back to get a search warrant. By the time they got back, the whiskey had been, they had a field that they were planting and dragging. It had been plowed and they were dragging it. So they took two barrels at a time, covered it with a burlap sack, and went to the end of the field, which there was an old quarry there, rock quarry. They hid the barrels of whiskey there, and when the revenue agents returned, while all of the whiskey had been hauled over to the quarry, and again they found nothing except some whiskey that we kiddos had spilled, and it was draining down the gutter. My father also tells the story about having a still in Wicklund. He ran it there a lot. It ran it there during Prohibition. My uncle was working there when some of the agents came to make a raid. So he was tipped off, and he ran up and got on the roof until they left. I don't think anyone was caught there. Maybe they were. I believe they were. I believe there's two people was caught there, but I don't recall who they were. This might have been after they ran out of whiskey that he went back to the stills after he ran out of whiskey from Barton, hauling it from there. And my father had another, this wasn't a story, I saw this. He had a house that someone lived in, was working for him and running a still in that house, and in the basement of that house. And it was located about a half a mile from our house. And the house caught on fire and burned to the ground. So after we heard, we could see the smoke from our house, and we all begged Mother to let us go down there. Well, after she found out that there was no one there, she let us go. We saw all the barrels filled with mash, and at that time, we were about 6, 7, 8, and 9 years old. This is another story that we were living in here in Nelson County out on a farm. And one Sunday afternoon, we had gone horseback riding. We were really too little to be on horses, but we were. And we rode up in the woods, continued on until we were on some other people's property, which I do not know the owner. And we came upon this still that was being staked out. We did not know that it was being staked out, or we didn't know it was there. There was a number of old hogs laying around drunk. We would kick them and they would just grunt. There was a lot of barrels of mash, whiskey was there, corn, some sugar, and finally 3 or 4 men appeared out of nowhere, and they were very angry with us because they said we messed up their raid. And now that I'm going to my, that was on my father's side. Now my mother's side, my great grandfather Henry Thomas Cravens, on the other side of my family, he lived to be past 90 and worked at the distillery most of his time. All of his work was legal. He was a distiller at Greenbrier. He raised 13 children while he lived there in the house on the distillery property. My grandmother was born there, and then she married. And my mother also was born there, and I think most of her children were born there. Now, Grandpa Cravens, Henry Thomas Cravens, said he used to go to different distilleries. He would take a train and ride a long time, and he would take a gallon of sour mash with him. And he would stay at these distilleries, overseeing the distillers, until the production was brought up. He went to Owensboro Distillery, which his son, was Joe Cravens, was the distiller there until he retired. Grandpa Cravens was considered the best distiller in Kentucky. And one of his grandsons, Robert Briney, was a distiller at Beam's Distillery, called Churchill Distillery earlier. He worked there with Booker Noel until Robert's death, or until he retired. He had also worked at other distilleries during the Prohibition and after, with his grandfather, Henry Thomas Cravens. I've heard many stories about before, during, about Prohibition, during and after. It seems many of my uncles and great uncles worked in the distillery with Grandpa Cravens, and then later on continued their work after Grandpa died. He died in 1945. My great uncle Jim Craven was the youngest son of Henry Thomas. He used to tell us about when he was 9, 10, 11, and 12 years old that he would go over to the distillery there at Greenbrier and drink beer out of the that's made before whiskey is taken out of it. And he never could hold his drinks. I don't know whether that had anything to do with it, but he was never able to hold a job. He was always lived with part of the family. He stayed with my parents a great deal of the time, but for the last years, he spent the last 15 years with me before I got him a home with the Little Sisters of the Poor. He died in Detroit at their home after they left Louisville. I'm sure they took care of his soul as well as his body, since Sister used to tell me about him going to Mass every day while he was there. He was very satisfied there. It might have been because Sister gave him 2 or 3 bottles of beer each day. That's it.
So, but I imagine it must be frustrating to find a name on a page or a date and not know anything about the personality behind that name or that date or that piece of paper. That's one of the limitations that oral history has. You can only go back to your time so far. Now, as I said earlier, oral history is one of the oldest methods. Used up until the present, so we've got a long and rich history of oral history. John Filson, for instance, perhaps you're familiar with that name, Herbert Filson, one of the earliest historical societies in the state. John Filson was a school teacher from Pennsylvania who came to Kentucky and was interested in Dan Boone and managed to track Dan Boone down. Finally gone to live in Missouri. This is in the 1810s. And Filson went to Missouri and interviewed Daniel Boone about his life. This is a wonderful story. He got to Missouri and he had some kind of vague directions as to where Daniel Boone lived. He got into the vicinity of Anchor neighborhood and was asking about him, asking where this Colonel Boone lived. And this woman said, "I have no idea, I've never heard of him." "Oh, you know, he's that old man, lives up the creek. Spends all his time hunting or whatever it is." Didn't have a very high reputation with his neighbors. But it's interesting to think that Filson was doing oral history and wrote his History of Kentucky and the Adventures of Daniel Boone on the basis of oral information. He went to the source and talked to him. He also interviewed veterans of the War of 1812, veterans of the Indian Wars in the Old Northwest. There are oral histories that were gathered from Revolutionary War soldiers that are in the National Archives. There are oral history interviews with Civil War veterans. Where those are, I'm not sure. I do a lot of research out west, and I've come across a number of local histories. This one in particular is my favorite, a county in northeastern California that was settled in the 1870s, between the 60s and 70s, long after the gold rush. And in 1908, a man set out to write the history of the county and says in his introduction that he tried to search out as many old-timers as he could because they were the ones who really knew what had happened. And what's wonderful about this particular account is he says, whatever they said, I took as truth. And sometimes there were discrepancies. People didn't agree exactly what happened. And he said, well, people remember things differently. And so he included everyone's account. He has all different versions. It's a kind of an ideal model of how to do oral history. This is back in 1908. In the 1930s, of course, the Writers Project of the WPA program collected extensive oral histories, particularly of former slaves and their children, and also a tremendous amount of county local history that is in various places in different states. Now, some as I've said, oral history has been a kind of continuous ongoing process, but it has fallen into disrepute, or it fell into disrepute, I should say, among professionally trained historians, long about the end of the 19th century, when historians were busy trying to become scientific and objective. And what they decided was that information that was contained in documents that were contemporary with the event they described, a letter, a diary entry, a report, that those were the only kinds of documents to be substantially relied upon. They were not interested in, and they disparaged, oral traditions, information that was not contemporary with the event that happened. And it has taken us a long time to get over that anti-oral tradition bias. But fortunately, oral history has continued on the local level and is now back in favor among professional historians, most professional historians. Part of that turnaround came in 1948. There was an eminent American historian named Alan Nevins at Columbia University, who in the course of doing his own research discovered the value of using old sources, among other things he did in biography. And in 1948, Professor Nevins established a formal oral history program. Other programs were then established at other universities and libraries around the country, including Berkeley, UCLA. And since then, oral history, particularly in the 60s and 70s and on up to the present, has been tremendously popular among professional historians and amateur or local historians as well. And there are several reasons why oral history comes back into vogue in this post-World War II period. One is a change in the way people communicated. During this period, people began to rely more and more on the telephone. What are the implications of the telephone for the historian? What happens? There are no letters. On the other hand, we do have a voluminous amount of material that does get preserved sometimes, but people began to rely more on the telephone. Secondly, there's a technological advance. A portable tape recorder is developed. It is small enough, it is handy enough, it is inexpensive enough to be affordable and to allow people to use it readily. So it makes it easy to do oral history. And finally, there gets to be a growing interest, particularly in the 60s and 70s, in subjects that ordinarily don't show up in written sources. Women's lives, the lives of ethnic groups. These gentlemen here from Georgetown College were just telling us about a group of Hungarians in Eastern Kentucky. Their lives would be so interesting to investigate. Local events that don't show up in standard histories. There have been two ways in this recent use of oral history, two ways in which oral history has been used. One is oral history has been used in standard historical research. People who are interested in political history and economic history go out and interview individuals who were involved in events on the national level. Oral history is used to contribute to our understanding of those events. But oral history has also been used to provide information about the people who have been left out of history. I'm going to make a terrible confession before I figure. When I was a child, I hated history. But I hated it because in the school books, there were no people. You had no idea what people wore, what people ate, what games they played, how they lived, what their houses were like. All you found out about were what laws were passed, huge hordes of people moving across the land, but no individuals, no human life, no sense of the importance of what went on at the local level. Terry kind of mentioned that I had just published a book. It was based on oral history research I did in Oregon, in eastern Oregon, which is a desert part of the state. And the people that I talked to had lived in this little community all of their lives. It's a harsh environment. One woman in particular was born in 1900 and was brought to the desert when she was a baby, 6 months old. Lived there all her life. She now lives in Reno. The publisher chose a photograph in her collection that she loaned me. A picture of her and her mother and a group of other women in 1912. We put that on the cover of the book. I sent her a copy of the book and she wrote back and said, I never thought I'd be on the cover of the book. And it touched me for her to write that way, to respond that way. It gave her a sense of her own importance. And it made me feel as though I had done something important. And it repeated for me a lesson that oral history can teach us. Oral history provides a means of recovering aspects of the past that aren't available from other sources, that traditionally have been ignored by academic historians whose work and writing have shaped our notions of what the past was like, of what was important about it. And we all have this sense from grade school, what's important is what's in the books. But what is really important is what happened to people. And oral history can recover that. Oral history, therefore, has an incredible significance, not only as an academic enterprise, as a research enterprise, but also as a human enterprise. You're involved with working with human beings directly, and it has the potential of revolutionizing our sense of what's important, on the local level as well as on the national level.
What Barbara didn't mention was the title of the book, and I'll do that for her. The book is called Homesteading the High Desert. And it is a good example of things you not only have oral sources, but integrated to be able to get to the point two printed documents or things of that sort were available. My task right now is to talk about the uses of oral history. I think I wanted to start off in it by saying that actually I use oral history as a means of making a living, but that wouldn't be appropriate.
Sure would.
I'm very pleased to be a part of this forum this morning to give you some of the ways that you can use oral history. One of the leaves, and this is philosophical really at first, but one of the ways that I do use oral history is to help people at the local level tell their own story. Most of our people out there at the local level certainly have the ability to write, at least to communicate, but they don't take the time to write down things, and they certainly don't take the time to think that they're intimidated from ever attempting to write a book, this sort of thing. And that's one of the things that we who have been through the academy, I think, can do in the way that we use oral history is to interview those people and help them tell their story. And I dedicated myself to this task a long time ago. I first started doing oral interviewing with and among the black people of Cumberland County, Kentucky. My book just came out, The Saga of Full Ridge, and I saw at that point in time that one of the most noble things, if I can use the term, that a woman can do is to help people write history. And by getting involved in oral history, it's a grand enterprise. I'm glad I got into it, and that's been a long time ago. It wasn't long after my Saga of Full Ridge came out. That was in 1970, I believe. There was a several people, but anyway, it was back years and years ago. But not long after it came out, I was over in southern Cumberland County again, this time a white community. There was an old white man there who was a Mr. Flowers. And he commented that he had either seen the Saga of of all, what will be the manner and the shape of the presentation? How will you present your materials? Will it be through museum exhibits, interpretations? Will it be radio, television programming? Will it be through newspaper accounts, feature stories? Will it be through books, pamphlets, things of the sort? You really need to have in mind the medium through which you will disseminate this information before you get started. It helps you to keep the focus on what it is you're doing. That's not to say that you can't go back later on and do something else with the material, but at least you need to have an original purpose in mind. So how will be the manner and the shape of the presentation? Secondly, how will you evaluate the evidence for historical accuracy? And Barbara is going to speak at least in part on this question later on this morning. And then thirdly, how will you interpret the evidence to the viewer or the reader? Will you present it in a straightforward manner, or will you attempt to find the evidence and the meaning in the material? In other words, you just present the account of your grandfather's life, or do you somehow make an effort to present your grandfather's life in wider perspective? Maybe in terms of the history of that part of the state, or maybe in terms of some of the history of the community, whatever it might be. In my study of killings, and I know this is probably back there on the table, I gather information about from individuals, but I was not focusing the study on individuals. Rather, I was looking at families and the role of these families in the community. Finally, a composite of the families and their roles in the community permitted me to see the origin and development of certain regional culture and values. Put it all together, I was able to see what was at work within the community. And I will say which one, because if it is simply a straddle at the Tennessee line, it is essentially a black community, it is a community that developed a pattern of homicidal behavior as the means of maintaining social order, social control. And so a oral interviewing will help you get patterns of that sort. But, now there is a handout in your packet that has the uses of oral history, advantages of using oral history, and disadvantages of using oral history. Now, the truth of the matter is, I don't expect that what you'll be doing, by and large, will be a project that will take 2 or 3 years to complete. I'm perfectly aware of that. Most of you will be involved in organizing people back home into some sort of effort that maybe, hopefully, will culminate in something before the bicentennial. And certainly, you will want at least to focus on the bicentennial, but you don't have the time yourself to go out and do all of this work. So your task will be to go back home and mobilize people into an effort focusing on getting together the history of your group, the history of your community, or Kai Erickson talk with the survivors of the Buffalo Creek flood in West Virginia some 2 years ago. The people who were colonized are basically from that moving experience. She talked with them and put in the book form called Everything in Its Path. Simply documenting the impact of a contemporary event on the community and on the community's mind. It's a very important thing that we can do here. Tenthly, to assist in historic preservation efforts. Now, I understand that some of you are here because of your interest in historic preservation. I'm talking about tangible properties. Daniel over here and his colleagues, let's see, it's Chris, John, and what was the other one? Stan. They're here from historic properties this morning. What you can do, you can use oral history, oral recollections in locating, describing, and dating structures. And let me quickly add, you can use oral history as well in describing a structure's contents. How many of you can recall back in the old days what it was like, let's put your grandma and grandpa, what it was like to go into their house and you recall certain pieces of furniture in a certain location in the house? I recall that my grandmother used to sleep in the kitchen. Grew up in the world, and how gross it would be to sleep in the kitchen. Well, I read one of the most interesting articles I ever read in my life was an article published here in, I think it was, in the British Isles, and it was an article about the positioning, the places where certain pieces of furniture were located in the house, and this article I found out most people all slept in the kitchen, the winter bus. Now, I was talking to a woman from Jamestown, Tennessee about 3 years ago in connection with my kiddo's book. I'm getting away from the artistry here. Forget that I said Jamestown, Tennessee, wouldn't you? And in a way, she grew up in a log house. Now, we did logs this day and time. We really came to the stuff. But the truth of the matter is, when people had to live in those log houses, they tried to disguise them every way possible. And so what they did, so this woman said, was in her log house, they would take hues of strips of muslin or sheeting and would actually, from concealing the floor, would hang sheets behind the logs. Here can we go and help you find information that has to do with log house. And then, 11, to assist in museum preservation efforts. You people who are interested in interpreting history through artifactual exhibits, sometimes you can go wrong if you follow the manual. And I'll be quick on this. But back in Canada, some just a very few years ago, maybe 8 or 10 years back, the Canadian one of the Canadian provinces wanted to honor its boys, soldier boys, who had fought in World War II. And so they got some mannequins to know, and they were going to get down to this exhibit, simply to show what the uniform was like that the driver of the fighting troops had used, and how they were worn. And they had the manual, the regulation to say you have to wear the uniform a certain way, and you have to have the buckles strapped a certain way and all of that. That's the way the museum interpreters set this exhibit up. Well, lo and behold, in came some of those fellows who had worn these uniforms, and they just rolled in the aisles, right? Because not a single one of them had worn a uniform like the manual had called for. Why? Because Canada didn't like England. It was already, you see, trying to break away from its English heritage. And anything that the England said, do it this way, Canada and and then we'll have a break. She's going to be talking about evaluating the work. You will be available during the lunch period and for a while this afternoon in the event you do want to approach us individually. And at 11:30, we will simply have an open discussion for a half hour. We promise you we'll try to hold our schedule. So that all of you can have a time at that point to ask or to exchange records.
Real briefly, I'm not sure I can do it in 8 minutes, but about how to evaluate oral history. One of the first questions that people ask about oral history is, how can you tell if it's true? There is still a residue of distrust of oral sources. But in fact, any historian will ask that question of any source. How can this source be evaluated for accuracy? Now, evaluating oral history, weighing it analytically as historical evidence means, first of all, recognizing what the nature of oral history is that makes it different from other sources of information. First of all, oral history is retrospective. Oral history is not contemporary with the event that it describes. It is necessarily looking back at the past from the point of view of the present. If there's anything we have learned this summer by watching television, it is that memory is fallible. Memory can be convenient, but also memory is fallible. Oral history is the product of memory. You're looking back at the past from the point of view of the present. Therefore, you are not describing it as it happened then, but as you remember it, that will happen. Secondly, this is an important point to remember too, that in doing oral history, you are going out and asking someone questions designed to elicit memories about a particular event or experience or set of experiences. Therefore, oral history is consciously created as historical evidence. It's not like a census record. It's not like a will. It's not like tax records. It is something that is deliberately created. And different interviewers will elicit different information from people. So that any oral history testimony is the result of the interview situation itself. And then finally, oral history reflects largely the experience of an individual. Even though I talked about the fact that you know a lot of things that other people have told you, it's largely your perspective on the world. That's why when you're doing an oral history project in a community, it's to your advantage to interview as many people as possible so that you get a large cross-section and you get a broad perspective on what happened. Okay, nuts and bolts here. Once you understand that oral history is a special kind of source of information about the past, how can you tell it's true? How can you analyze it? The first step that you take is to measure the information, test the information that you've gathered against all of the sources of information, written sources, part of the brain. Is the information that the person gave you in an oral history interview basically consistent with what is already known from primary records? Or is there a very fundamental discrepancy between the two? We've always assumed, as Lindwood said, that the printed source is correct and the oral source is an error. Census records, for instance, which we tend to regard with a great deal of respect, are in fact fallible records. In the research that I happen to know in this particular instance, the research that Lindwood has been doing, in the 1910 census he was looking at, he came across the name of a woman whom he knew because he had taught her. She was one of the people that he was regularly interviewed in this area. And it listed her in the census, she was a little child then, as a boarder in her grandfather's house. She was, in fact, an illegitimate child. And her mother was living in her father's house. The child was listed as a boarder. There's another case of the fallibility of our census records in that one particular family, whom everybody in the community talked about because they were moonshiners and independent notorious characters, don't show up in the census records at all. I'm not quite sure why, but the census people break, go back there and find them, or were they so far back in the weekend? So don't always assume that the written source is correct and the oral source is an error. You have to weigh them both. The second test of oral information doesn't make sense. Is it logical? Could it have happened? I'm not talking here about accounts, perhaps, of the supernatural, which fall into a special kind of category, but one of the favorite examples that Linda and I like to use is the account in a local history of people who brought sheep into an area very early on, and the wolves in the area interbred with sheep and created a strange kind of animal. This makes no sense. Is it logical? Could it possibly have happened with this person? Thirdly, and this is a little difficult perhaps for people who are just starting out in oral history to pick up on or to understand, but does the story that the person is telling you sound a little bit too good to be true? And have you heard similar stories in other places? Let me give you our favorite example. Very often in oral accounts, particularly in family stories, family legends, there will be a story about a grandmother or a great-grandmother who was away from the invariably a log cabin one day, sometimes with the baby. And she's been picking berries or she's been visiting a neighbor, getting food from a neighbor. And on her way home, she hears a strange noise in the road behind her and turns around. Oh, behold, there's a huge panther in a tree behind her. And she says, aha, I see the laws of recognition here. She begins to run. And of course, the panther, begins to chase her. Well, the woman is resourceful. And she has a baby in her arms, let's say. She begins stripping the baby's clothes off, throwing them in the road behind her, and the panther going, and she starts stripping off her own clothes, finally collapses into the cabin, slams it over, and just at the last minute, just before she has to rip off the last shred of her clothing. This is a great story, and people who tell you this story, I'm sure this lady wrote, this really happened. What happened is... Okay. Sometimes if you begin looking around, you'll discover the same story is told in other same thing have happened in different places, in this case, or is this a case of a story that was just, it's a perfect example of what might have happened. Out west, my favorite example of this kind of story is about a dance. Out west, you know, these were isolated people who had to travel great distances, and social events were very much looked forward to. So when a dance was scheduled, everyone came from miles around the whole block. Everybody with them, little kids included. And they would dance all night. And the little kids, of course, would get tired and sleepy, and so they would put the babies to bed in another room, lay them on the floor or lay them on the bed. And at some point during the evening's festivities, a couple of the young men, or whoever it might be, would think it would be a real good idea to go into the other room and start switching the clothes on the babies, you know, take the clothes off this one and put it on that one, take the clothes off and so forth. So that when people got ready to leave, they were in a hurry to get home, and they'd grab up the quilt that they recognized for the coat, and then they'd get home 50 miles away and have the wrong kid. I collected this story in Oregon, told by a man who swore he did it. But the story shows up in Owen Lister's novel, The Virginian, which is written in 1903, and it shows up all over the West. Again, you have to ask yourself the question, did this really happen, or is this a story about what happened? That's a question that you need to ask of all sources. What am I? Number four, you must measure the information that you get from all sources against the information you collect from other people. Is the individual you're talking with consistent with himself or herself? Do people contradict themselves in their own moral testimony? Is the information that you gather consistent with what other people have told you? Now you have to allow, of course, for discrepancies. As this one point I have in Northern California again, so everybody has a version. When I was doing interviewing out in Oregon, there was a terrible fire that had taken place on Christmas Eve in this community. We were having a Christmas program up on the second floor of a store building in the community hall. Some amount of kerosene lamp over the place went up immediately. And as soon as the fire broke out, a young man who was downstairs in the store saw what was happening, jumped on a horse, and rode to the nearest doctor, who was 100 miles away. Several people told me the story of the young man's ride. And they had different accounts of how long it took him, how deep the snow was, how long it took the doctor to get back. There were a lot of discrepancies in the oral testimony of the witness. But the important thing was that someone had gone to the doctor to come back to help the people in distress. No matter how long it took, the doctor to see the snow was on the ground. And you have to weigh and sift oral testimony to see how important those discrepancies are. Are they simply colorful details? Dramatic details, or is there not some core of truth as part of it? And then finally, the fifth point that you have to consider is consider the source itself. What kind of reputation does the person you're talking to have? Is this a reliable person or not? One man I talked to out in Oregon, an older woman in the community said, well, you have to take what he says with a grain of salt. This is the man who told me about switching the baby's clothes at the dance, okay? How reliable is this person? How reliable is the person's memory? Who gets a sense of this? Maybe because you know the individual yourself when you've heard other people talk about that person. I might point out, and I don't do this as a selling technique, but some of these points, Linda and I have elaborated upon in our book, Community History, using the most sources in local historical research. And we go into some of the details to how to evaluate, how to weigh the what you're interested in is reconstructing what happened. And oral sources need to be weighed as much as written sources. Time to take a break?
Well, I think the history of medical science, whatever the value of the truth in the next section, we need to find out if there are the comments and questions in the discussion. In other words, the other way to make it clear. So, we need disagreement.
Several people had practically exactly the same numbers that we're just doing in the other one.
the things you cannot rely on oral evidence for is dates. But fortunately, except in the case that you haven't mentioned, dates are usually the easiest thing to find out from your sources. And if you've done even the least amount of work that other people talk, and you get a back on experience, you know that people engage in what we call relative dating. If you ask someone when something happened, they'll say, well, now that was before I was married, or that was after my second child was born, or they'll date it relative to other things that have happened. But don't ever rely on